It's a tremendous pleasure for me to welcome Naomi Klein, Jeremy Scahill to Miami.
Thank you so much, Em. I'm delighted to be here. I'm always delighted to share the podium with my very dear friend, Jeremy Scahill, who you could tell started this by asking me whether I had any paper.
He
brought his own pen. But then you will see why I always insist on speaking before Jeremy. It's a little deal we have. I bring the paper, he closes. I'm very, very pleased to be here. I'm going to talk a little bit about the book, and I'm going to talk a lot about the bailout, if that's okay. Let's not hear it for the bailout. The trillion-dollar crime scene, the $700 billion stick-up. I'm just looking at how much time we have. There's a lot to say about the bailout. The shock doctrine is an alternative history of how we ended up with this Wild West brand of capitalism, what the French call savage capitalism, this no rules, so-called free market that is imploding so spectacularly before our eyes. We have been sold a fairy tale version of history that tells us that this way of organizing societies that is really has really been a liberation movement for capital, liberating itself from all the barriers to the accumulation of obscene profits. That's really the history that we've been living, this counter-revolution against the New Deal. We're told that this swept the world peacefully and democratically because people wanted these policies of privatization, of deregulation, of deep cuts to social spending. What I'm arguing in the shock doctrine is that we cannot understand how this very unpopular ideology triumphed around the world without understanding the role that crisis has played at every turn, the role that shocks play at every turn. And that's what I mean by the shock doctrine. What I mean by the shock doctrine is a political strategy that is deeply understood at the highest reaches of power, and it is high time that regular people understood this strategy as well. And by the way, I think that we're catching on, as Ham alluded to. And that strategy is that if you have a set of very unpopular policies that benefit the elites but don't benefit regular people, then the only time you can push through this ideology in the way that economists describe as economic shock therapy, pushing it through all at once. I'm not talking about the gradual approach. I'm talking about the big bang moment, the moments when you get it all through at once, like Thatcher's Britain, like Russia in the midst of the economic crisis in the 90s. You need a crisis because a crisis creates a state of emergency. When we are in a state of shock, we regress. We become childlike. We start thinking, oh, I don't know, that Rudy Giuliani is our daddy and he's going to take care of us, and that really Henry Paulson is looking after us and we can trust him. That's what I mean by the shock doctrine. And there is a window of opportunity that opens up in the midst of crisis. When we are panicked, when we are focused on daily emergencies, when it is possible to push through these policies without debate. So this strategy is a democracy avoidance strategy. It is a way to get around democracy, even if you happen to live in a democracy, even if you happen to live in an electoral democracy. So what I do in the book is I trace the various kinds of shocks, the various kinds of crises that have played this enabling role since this ideology began spreading throughout the world. It didn't begin with Reagan and Thatcher. It began with Pinochet in the 70s. Pinochet's Chile was the first laboratory for Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys, the first place to privatize Social Security, the first place to introduce a flat tax, policies that the Republican Party in this country has yet to find a crisis big enough to be able to exploit, although they are still trying on their way out the door. So in the 70s, they didn't have to find their way around democracy. They just overthrew democracies in Uruguay, in Argentina, in Chile, in Brazil. And in the aftermath of those shocks, they pushed through these radical policies, and they got rid of the opponents of those policies with very real shocks to their bodies. And all of these three shocks, the shocks to countries, the shocks to economies, and the shocks to bodies, formed a kind of a perfect storm that created that first laboratory for this violent ideology, for this violent market fundamentalist ideology. In the 80s, it was the debt shock. It was the economic crisis that forced countries in a state of panic, in a state of desperation, to go to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and meet the market fundamentalists there, who said, you're in some trouble? You've got a market crisis? Well, we're not going to bail you out exactly. We might give you a loan, but attached to that loan is a whole set of measures, like privatizing your phone system, your electricity system, your oil, your water, your roads. Oh, and you're going to have to cut back. You're going to have to cut funding to education. Introduce school fees and health care. This is also a violent process. This was the so-called peaceful period. I also look at the role that economic transitions, rapid-fire political change, changes from one regime to the next. And sometimes it can be a happy transition, like the end of apartheid or the collapse of communism. But it creates a period of such profound change, such profound dislocation, that it is possible to push through very rapid change all at once. And I wrote this book because I had the experience of living in a country that had experienced one of these very rapid political transitions in the 80s, Argentina. This was one of the first laboratories for this ideology. But what most interested me about what had happened in Argentina is that when the dictatorship ended and democracy came, in that period, everyone was focused on the big P politics, on the fact that they could finally vote, on the fact that they were closing the torture centers. And what I heard from so many of my friends in Argentina was that they felt that they had missed something in that political transition, that they had missed the economic side of it. And so they had been able to overthrow the political regime, but the economic system that had been imposed with so much violence remained intact. And then I went to South Africa and I spent some time there, and I met a lot of people who told me the same thing about the transition in South Africa when they finally overthrew apartheid and had a democratically elected government that brought Nelson Mandela to power in 1994. I spoke to many wonderful South African journalists, a third-generation ANC-er investigative journalist named William Gomede, who said this thing to me that really resonated with me. He said, we missed it. And what he was talking about was the way in which the economic system of apartheid managed to pass itself on, even under democracy. He said, we missed it. And that reminded me of something I heard in Argentina about what they had missed in their period of rapid change, of their political transition. Because, of course, the liberation movement in South Africa wasn't just about the right to vote and the right to freedom of speech for all people and freedom of movement. It was about the fact that apartheid was an economic system as well as a political system which had dramatically concentrated wealth in the hands of the white elite. And part of the promise of liberation was that redistribution, that nasty word, of those ill-gotten gains. And that was the platform, the economic platform of the ANC. That's the election they ran on in 1994. But in the key transition period, they locked in several of the key figures, like the head of the central bank and the finance minister. That was part of the deal when they handed over power and they agreed to have elections. The outgoing apartheid government said, we want to keep our apartheid-era central banker and our apartheid-era finance minister in your new democracy. This is one of the great untold stories, right? In Argentina, the elected Peronist government of Carlos Menem, who came to power as a man of the people, vindicating the crimes of the past, he appointed the head of the central bank from the dictatorship, a man named Domingo Cavallo. Any Latin Americans in the crowd, they know that name. Domingo Cavallo was made famous because his last act as central banker, as head of the central bank under the dictatorship, was to nationalize the debts of the largest corporations in Argentina, including the multinationals like Citibank, like Ford, like IBM. It was the parting gift. Sound familiar? We'll take your debts. You can keep the profits. Well, to reassure the markets during the debt crisis in the late 80s, Menem appointed Cavallo, and the market cheered. A 30% increase in the Buenos Aires Stock Exchange, applauding the return. They call it economic continuity. Be careful of people talking about smooth transitions from corrupt regimes. If you want change, if you vote for change, you're going to have some rocky moments along the way. There is no way to transition from a corrupt regime marked by illegality, marked by methods that we have rejected, like torture, and not have a few bumps along the way. Somehow, we have accepted this idea that you can vote for change, but then you can have a smooth, seamless transition that won't alarm the market, that won't alarm anyone. That's how you get the status quo, because the market votes for the status quo. It doesn't want change. And people have just voted for change. And there is no way to reconcile those two forces without accepting that it's going to be rocky. Now, I wrote the book because this strategy of exploiting these moments of disorientation, the moments when we're all focused on big P politics, on who's getting the top appointments, on what was said in the latest speech, on the pageantry of politics, that we don't read the fine print. But that strategy only works if we don't know it's a strategy. If we don't know it is a strategy. If we know it's a strategy, it stops working, because the whole thing is about exploiting our disorientation, exploiting our regression. So, the bailout. Well, you know, colonial rulers, European colonial rulers had this habit when they finally realized they had to hand over power to the indigenous population, they would loot the treasury on the way out the door. The Portuguese in Mozambique poured cement down the elevator shafts. They were particularly vindictive. I think that this bailout should be understood as the Bush administration's final pillage. That is actually what we're seeing here. And it goes well beyond the $700 billion, and it's far more than $700 billion when you count Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and when you count the loans that are being handed out. With no accountability, that's up to $2 trillion. We're talking multi-trillion dollars here. And it goes beyond that, because after they finish looting the Treasury, then the real crisis begins. And that's the crisis in the public books. That's the transfer of a private economic crisis, a private sector crisis, to the public sector. And then all the things that people have been saying, yes, we can, about, yes, we can have alternative energy, yes, we can have health care for all Americans, then it becomes, in an instant, no, we can't. Sorry, we can't afford it. We've just spent all the money. We don't have any money left, right? So all the people who've been selling this bailout then become the naysayers. So think about it as Republican insurance against the promise of real political change in this country. It only works if we don't know about it, if we don't understand that this is a tactic. Now, think about that original three-page ransom note that Henry Paulson presented the country with, right? Incredibly included this clause that said explicitly that Treasury would be given $700 billion to do with what it liked, and that the decisions made under the bailout could not be challenged by any arm of government and by any court of law. Remember that? And in some ways, this gives me hope, because people recognized this pattern in that moment, right? It was a moment of pattern recognition. We called it the Economic Patriot Act, right? We said, haven't we seen this before, a moment of crisis, and they rammed through this legislation? You know, the real mistake that they made was how short it was. The Patriot Act was really long. People didn't read it until it was too late. This was three pages, and everyone read it. Everyone read it but John McCain. And they linked to it, and they blogged about it, and they said no. And the part of it that was most controversial was the lack of oversight, was the idea of a blank check. So in order to get the bailout passed, it had to be pretty significantly reworked. And we were all reassured now that there were all kinds of checks and balances in place, that there were going to be all of these people doing oversight, that they weren't going to be able to do whatever they wanted. Now, a month and a half later, we find out that while Treasury has been extremely efficient in handing out $290 billion already to the banks in these equity deals and to AIG, they have so far not made any of the key oversight appointments. In other words, all this time, nobody has been watching the store. But I think what's also important to understand is that Paulson has achieved by stealth, by what they call incompetence, all right, exactly what he originally tried to do explicitly, which is whatever he wanted, okay, with no oversight whatsoever. Now, this is important to understand for a couple of reasons. And they're not just handing out these equity deals to the banks. You know, the specialty of the Bush administration, and this is where, you know, mine and Jeremy's work has really intersected very strongly, has been setting themselves very ambitious goals and then hiring other people to do their jobs for them, right? These are the outsourcers in chief. They have created a hollow shell where the government used to be. It still looks like a government. Still, you know, they still play a government on TV. But every part of what we consider core government services has been outsourced, right? And Blackwater, of course, is the ultimate example and the most frightening example of this. They've run the bailout in exactly the same way. They announced this, and it is the new trough. After Homeland Security and Iraq, the entire thing is being run by private accounting firms and by the same banks and the same Wall Street law firms that got us into this mess. So I'm just going to tell you about one contract that was handed out to a law firm to advise the Treasury about these equity deals that they negotiated with the banks, okay, which they were calling nationalization. And I think we got that wrong. I don't think it's Treasury that nationalized the banks. I think it's the banks that privatized Treasury. I don't really even understand why they needed to outsource this part of the job, because if there's one thing they have at Treasury, it's former Goldman Sachs executives who know how to make these deals. That's all they know how to do. Nonetheless, they felt they needed to hand out a contract to a law firm to give them advice on these deals. The firm that got the deal is called Simpson, Thatcher & Bartlett. The first test for the bailout was that meeting that Henry Paulson had with the 9 CEOs of the largest banks in the country. And they announced in 1 hour that Paulson had strong-armed these banks into accepting $150 billion of taxpayer money. He's so tough, right? Well, so this was Simpson Bartlett Thatcher's first gig, okay, this deal. Now, what was interesting, when I started looking into this one company, I wrote a piece about it for Rolling Stone. You can read it on their website or on my website. Simpson Bartlett Thatcher has represented 7 of those 9 banks. 7 of those 9 banks, okay? They are the quintessential Wall Street law firm. They've negotiated some of the biggest bank mergers in recent times. And maybe we could say, well, we want the best. You know, we want the best deal makers available. Well, here's the problem, right? Taxpayers represent a fraction of the business that these banks represent to Simpson, Bartlett, and Thatcher. And the deal that they helped Treasury negotiate, as we now know, is an extremely bad deal. Now, we were told that they were doing this, that they were injecting $25 billion in some banks, $10 billion in others, in order to address the credit crunch, in order to get money flowing, lending flowing, right? Well, the first rule in deal making is get it in writing, okay? Gordon Brown, 5 days earlier, negotiated a deal with British banks. He got 15% dividends for British taxpayers. He got seats on the board, voting rights, and he got it in writing that they had to spend the money that he was injecting, that they were injecting, on loans to small businesses and taxpayers. So what did Paulson, the tough guy, and their Wall Street law firm get? They got 5% as opposed to 15%, no voting rights, no seats on the board, and they didn't get it in writing. that they were supposed to start lending. So lo and behold, the banks decided not to. They decided to pay it out to their shareholders, to pay it in salaries, to pay it in bonuses, and to start buying other banks, which will turn around and say when they get into trouble that they're too big to fail, and we have to bail them out too. Now, this may very well be illegal. A lot of what we're finding out now is that this is illegal. And, you know, we also have found out recently that they've slipped in $140 billion tax windfall to encourage these mergers. So that's money out of the pocket of the U.S. government. And to put that in perspective, Barack Obama's alternative energy program is $150 billion. Okay? Just that tax windfall is pretty much the same amount as the alternative energy program. The healthcare program is half as much. Okay, so remember that when we hear "no, we can't" about all the things that have been demanded and voted for in this country. I'm not going to talk about Treasury, except to say that I think Larry Summers is more of the same. He's one of the people who got us into this mess, and it's the same logic that you have to sort of coddle this market that has this sort of personality of an ill-tempered two-year-old who throws a temper tantrum when anything gets taken away or changed. This is not a market that needs to be coddled. Barack Obama won this election by telling the American people something that was true, which is that this market failure is the failure of an ideology. It's the failure of the mania for deregulation. It is the failure of the idea that you give more and more to the people at the top and it trickles down to people at the bottom. You know, Larry Summers is somebody who wrote the rules that created this mess. He was Treasury Secretary under Clinton. You know, and we listened to Obama say, this is, you know, the culmination of 8 years of deregulation. No. It was not just 8 years. Glass-Steagall, which was the law that prevented investment banks from being in the same business as commercial banks, that was eliminated in 1999 when Larry Summers was Treasury Secretary. He introduced Bill Clinton when Bill Clinton signed that piece of legislation that more than any other created this crisis. He also was side by side with Alan Greenspan when they fought to keep derivatives from being in the reach of government regulators. Okay, so if you want change, if we really want change, it actually does require doing things that say there's a new sheriff in town, and the market will react badly, and then it will recover. The good news is that we're a little bit used to these shocks. They're a little bit less shocking. And I actually think there is a moment when it is possible to make good on some of these promises. The closer you are to the election where the promises are made, the easier it is to do. You know, we're hearing a lot about this idea that we might get a new deal, a new deal, or a green new deal, and that Obama is maybe the next FDR. We subscribe, unfortunately, I think, to this great man theory of history, which tells us that FDR handed the New Deal to us from on high because he was so enlightened, right? And we erase from so much of our history, from so much of the way we tell ourselves how we arrived here, this incredible struggle from below that forced FDR to introduce the New Deal and that allowed him to sell the New Deal to the elites in this country as a compromise, because the alternative for a while there looked like revolution. And, you know, Obama has said many, many times that he needs this incredible movement that brought him to power to stay mobilized. And, you know, FDR used to say when people presented him with a piece of progressive legislation, go out there and make me do it. I think that is the best gift that this president could be given, is a population that stays mobilized, that doesn't just go home and say, okay, we won, and relax, that keeps reading the fine print, that demands the change, that reminds the Republicans that they lost. And, you know, I think of this as the antithesis of what I'm calling disaster capitalism and the shock doctrine, which is the exploiting of crisis to get around democracy, to avoid democracy. We can use crisis to enlarge democracy. so that it isn't something that just happens every few years, so that it isn't a spectator sport. And so I think the disaster capitalists have had the reign for a long time now, and it's time for some disaster collectivism. Thank you.
Now I have to go ahead and say something after this. It's touche, Ms. Klein.